Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm Doug Berkey, filling in for Slick. Now today we're going to cover some key history. 20 years ago, America was still reeling from the terrorist attacks of 9/11. Crews were dealing with the wreckage of the World Trade Center in New York City, and people arriving for work every day at the Pentagon were walking by a gaping charred hole in the building. You know, yet at the same time, American men and women in uniform were engaged in combat halfway around the world in Afghanistan. Planning for this mission began hours after the 9/11 attack. Their mission was to terminate the organization responsible for those attacks and those that supported them. This mission commenced on October 7th, 2001, and with us today are some of the key planners and commanders who were involved in the start and execution of what became known as Operation Enduring Freedom, or OEF for short. The initial phase of that operation was an air campaign, working in concert with local Afghan ground forces and a limited number of special operations and CIA folks with them there on the ground as well. This combination is what secured those main objectives. In fact, we had already taken the entire country by the time the broader U.S. Army and Marine Corps had deployed into the region. So if you want to know about the decisive phase of Operation Enduring Freedom, it's a story about air power. And to better understand this history, we're honored to be joined by General Buzz Mosley, who's 18th Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Chuck Wald, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, and Major General Larry Stutstream. Now, each one of these individuals played a key role in the execution of that air campaign, with General Mosley and General Wald serving each as the head of Central Command Air Force's commander in back-to-back assignments, General Deptula commanding the Combined Air Operations Center, and General Stutstream as the Director of Operations for Joint Task Force Southwest Asia and Deputy Director of the Combined Air Operations Center. But if you want to cut to the chase, they're all air commanders in an absolutely pivotal moment in our nation's history. And today we're going to dig into that history and talk about the experiences and memories that none of them are ever going to forget. And you got to realize, the history that we're going to cover here is immense. The hours spent planning the war, executing it, the personal dynamics, you name it. So to give this the depth it really deserves, we're going to spread this conversation out over two episodes. Now today we're going to talk about the steps that occurred immediately after 9/11 and take you through some of the planning process. Next week we're going to talk more about executing the fight and other key considerations. So with that, gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Doug, thanks for having us, and thanks for the opportunity to share some thoughts. Thanks also for the opportunity to share the thinking and the screen with very, very dear friends that we go back a long way. So, Doug, thanks.
And, Doug, same here. I echo what General Mosley said, and it's great to see the four of you again. It brings back great memories. I look forward to the discussion today.
Good to be on, Doug. Thanks.
Great to be here, Doug.
Thanks, gentlemen. Really appreciate it. So let's just kick this off here at the beginning, and I want to do a scene setter. It's very unusual, this context. You know, General Mosley and General Wald, as I understand it, you're both in the Pentagon that morning of 11th of September, preparing for a change of command. And General Deptula, you are obviously there as well, running the Quadrennial Defense Review. And I just want to highlight, it is incredibly rare to have three senior air commanders actually at the scene of an attack that they then led the response to. So I just wanted to point that out to people. I think it's oftentimes lost in history. But General Mosley, first for you, you're running the Air Force Legislative Liaison Operation at the time. So you're the Air Force's main interface with Capitol Hill. What was the reaction in Congress as the members responded to the attack? Could you fill us in with that context?
Yeah, Doug, first let's go back. General Wald and I were in the process of a changeover discussion. General Wald had brought some of the key staff from Shaw up to Washington, and so we were in the process of kind of briefing each other, and then General Wald was going to come back to Washington. So he had a couple of things on his mind, and I was desperately attempting to escape being the legislative liaison guy and get back to the real world. So we were actually in an office on the E-ring, going through all of the initiatives, all of the issues, the intel, et cetera, and effectively a command handle. Prior to that morning, other than some of the things that had happened during the Clinton administration, there wasn't much focused on the Hill relative to the Middle East, other than a handful of players worried about potential terrorism. Because if you remember, the Clinton administration fired some TLAMs and did some things. And also remember, I think in October of 2000 was when the Cole was attacked in Aden Harbor. And so, and that was about the same week or 10 days that General Franks took over. That was his welcome to command, U.S. Central Command, was the attack on the Col. But the Hill was pretty quiet about all that, because we were in the process of catching up with a new presidential administration with new initiatives and new priorities. With the new SecDef, it was looking in every way to pare down some of the overhead in the department, and in his mind, to modernize and recapitalize the especially the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force. Also, remember at this time we were stuck in no-fly zones, and so the Hill knew that, and they knew of continual deployments, and they knew of the Col, and they knew of the Clinton attacks. But I would tell you, there wasn't a burning conversation prior to that morning in September from the legislative side, not at all. And effectively not in the building, to be honest.
No, I appreciate that. When you got the attack came in, and what then was the response? Obviously, it had to be a huge pivot. Were you guys inundated with questions from the Hill, or how did that work?
Well, these kind of things always revolve around personal relationships. General Wald and I go back to when we were babies together. And when the exec came in and said, looks like an airplane flew into a building in New York, we both kind of had little question marks on our head, but we were kind of continuing with this handover thing. And then when the exec came in and said, a second airplane, second building, these are airliners, this is the World Trade Center, Waldo and I both looked at each other and at the same time said, Al-Qaeda. And then about 20 minutes later, the building's hit. We're hit. The Hill was unified in a way. I'd say there was a lot of unity after that, because there was a sense of vulnerability. There was a sense of questioning. Where was the fourth airplane going to go? Was it the Capitol? Was it the White House? What is the real, how do you connect these dots? How did this happen to us without us knowing about it? I mean, those are kind of the standard questions. But there was a period of time on the Hill and the Armed Services Committees where there was a lot of unanimity. There was a lot of cooperation. It was fascinating to watch one day staff and members at each other's throats, and the next day staff and members looking to be helpful and proactive. So hopefully that helps, Doug.
No, I appreciate that context, sir. I mean, General Wald, turning to you, what were your first actions as the 9th Air Force CENTAF commander at that time? I mean, when did you start thinking about developing war plans here in response to the attack?
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate what General Mosley just said. I think, as he mentioned, it was pretty immediate. First of all, we were pretty surprised at the initial hit on the building in New York. And then the second one was pretty obvious. We went out on the river entrance together and were dumbfounded. That was what was going on. Matter of fact, when the airplane hit the Pentagon, I don't think either one of us even heard it. So that's kind of gives you a sense of how big the Pentagon is. But we went out on the river entrance lawn. And we're watching the building, plumes of smoke coming up, and Buzz and I talked about it. It became pretty apparent I had to get out of there because something was going to happen. We were going to have to respond. Frankly, there had been no planning whatsoever for this type of occurrence to respond in Afghanistan prior to that. Semi-shame on us, but primarily CENTCOM hadn't really thought about that. Matter of fact, I had been serendipitously traveled to Pakistan a couple weeks prior to the attack, because the Pakistanis had lifted, had the sanctions from the U.S. lifted on them after they disavowed the Taliban. So I was able to travel there, went up to the Khyber Pass, got a lecture on don't ever fight in Afghanistan, came back. It was time for Buzz and I to have a change of command. And that all changed immediately. Hal Hornberg, who had been a predecessor of ours in 9th Air Force, had set up a group called the Nifty 50, which was a group of 50 specialists in CENTAF at Shaw Air Force Base that would, in the occurrence of a crisis of some sort, travel to the Middle East and begin planning for whatever that occurrence would be. So I went out to Andrews Air Force Base, and as General Mosley mentioned, Congress was not only unified, but they were all trying to get out of D.C. at the time. And so there was dozens of congressmen and senators at Andrews Air Force Base. I was there, and the guard unit at McIntyre in South Carolina sent up an F-16. I flew to Shaw Air Force Base that afternoon. As a matter of fact, I was the only airplane airborne in the United States other than the cap over Washington, D.C., from F-16s and the F-15s up in Massachusetts. And the next day, a guy named General Mittermeier from McGuire Air Force Base brought a KC-10 to Shaw, and we flew into Prince Sultan on the 12th and began planning. But there was no previous planning for an attack on Afghanistan. It was all made up as we went along. But again, I think looking back on this, and General Deptula and Stutz can comment on this too, it kind of goes to show you the flexibility of air power from a standpoint of a dead stop with no planning, no pre-coordination, no warning, to be able to respond within a very short period of time to the national needs of the United States. And General Mosley can talk about this in detail, but on September 21st, which was 10 days after 9/11, we briefed the President of the United States and the staff on the plan going forward. General Franks had flown into Prince Sultan Air Base at that time, and we briefed the National Security Staff, senior level, on the plan. So from a dead stop, no notice, never thinking about it, to 10 days later, we had a plan of attack to go into Afghanistan. I think that speaks volumes about the Air Force.
That's incredible. Now, General Deptula, you're running the Air Force Quadrennial Defense Review at the time. So how did you get involved as the director of the Combined Air Operations Center? I mean, you know, one day you're wrapping up the QDR, and about 10 days later you're planning B-2 attacks on places in Afghanistan that no one in the Western world had ever heard of before.
Yeah, Doug, I was in my office in the Pentagon when the 9/11 attacker flew a 767 into the Pentagon just two quarters away. Needless to say, I rounded up the people in my directorate, and we got out of there. A few days later, the new Air Force Chief of Staff at the time, General John Jumper, asked me to come to his office. So I go down to his office, and General Jumper tells me that he received a call from General Wald, who, as we now know, but for the audience, he was the Central Command Air Forces and the Central Command Joint Force Air and Space Component Commander at the time. And he'd asked for me to come to Saudi Arabia to lead the Combined Air and Space Operations Center at Prince Sultan Air Base. Now, the KAOC facility had only been recently completed, and General Weld wanted me to help him plan and execute the attack on al-Qaeda and the Taliban harboring them in Afghanistan. So, just like General Weld just mentioned, from just a matter of days, we get spun up, and I found myself on my way again to the Persian Gulf 10 years after I'd been involved in planning the first Gulf War, Operation Desert Storm, and was soon engaged in frantic efforts to organize the staff, get the new KAOC facility ready to fight, and assist in continuing to develop the war plans for America's response to 9/11. The bottom line is we put together an innovative use of air power in conjunction with a light footprint of special operations folks, both partnering with the Afghan Northern Alliance in the opening stages of what became then known as Operation Enduring Freedom. And collectively, we accomplished what the previous 5 years of indigenous ground force operations could not, and that was the removal of the Taliban regime.
Thanks, sir. You know, Stutz, you were in theater when the attacks on 9/11 occurred. So what was the reaction there from you and your team? And then what were the challenges of shifting from an operation that where you're focused on the no-fly zone activities to one planning for an attack on al-Qaeda and the Taliban?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. Remember, it was General Deptula said, 10 years after Desert Storm, and Southern Watch was a very low tempo, very important, but low tempo operation that was protecting Shia in the southern part of Iraq. And it was a small headquarters. It was run by a cadre of folks who were on assignment for a year remote separated from their families. And early in 2001, the Saudis wanted us to move from where we were at, the Air Operations Center at Esgon Village, to Prince Sultan Air Base, as General Deptula mentioned. So when 9/11 occurred, we were in a shutdown mode, a pause in operations, and we're actually finishing wiring up a state-of-the-art, new concept Air Operations Center that was very, looking back on it, at the very front end of, you know, the merging, the fusion of information and communications. So we were in the main room, and we had these huge projections of information on the wall. Someone came running in. I was the senior guy on the scene at the time. The two-star that ran Southern Watch was off site, and said that the World Trade Center had been hit. And we actually put cable news up on the big wall. Suddenly, everybody came into that room, and we all watched as the second tower was hit. So like General Mosley said, there was no doubt. I assembled everybody and said, I don't know what's going on, but somewhere in this theater, we're going to go to war, and we got to get this CAOC put together. And I directed that we take down all the data. We were just being stunned by watching all this and the uncertainty of it. So thanks to a couple colonels that had coincidentally come forward, we were pulling fiber optic wire. We were setting desks up. We were making everything ready for the CENTAF team to come in. And I'll tell you, one thing that really helped was when General Wald and General Deptula came on scene, they were forceful leaders and took hold of the entire operation as their guys came in and really pushed a team of folks to do what I thought, reflecting back on at that time, was the impossible. And of course, the important thing, General Wald told me we should not do anything in Iraq that might open a second front. So we had to be very careful to continue to operate and monitor Southern Watch in Iraq as we were then planning for Afghanistan operations.
Wow. Well, Stutz, I've known you for years. I've never heard that story, so I'm glad we're doing this here today. So General Wald, can you walk us through how strategy development, the process for that, began to unfold? You know, as Air Component Commander, you're working for CENTCOM Commander General Tommy Franks. What were his directions to you?
Yeah, you know, you could unpack this for days, as General Mosley could probably attest to as well. He went through some of the similar things we did. But frankly, CENTCOM was ill-prepared for this. They hadn't thought about it. I think there's, matter of fact, ironically, and this is probably just a small anecdote, but the first VTC video teleconference we had with CENTCOM, I think Dave was there at the time, was a couple days after we arrived in Prince Sultan, and it was with CENTCOM to talk about what the way ahead would be. It was on a Saturday, and the CENTCOM staff was all in golf shirts on the VTC, which I thought was a little bit ironic. So I guess that's kind of a metaphor for they had really not thought about this, as we hadn't either, but they hadn't spun up yet. So the real issue was we knew we had to do some retaliation. It was fairly obvious who it was going to be against. There were some complexities involved, and Dave was a big part of the planning of this, but part of the issue we ran into early was the Saudi Arabians would not let us fly over Saudi Arabia with munitions on board, nor would other countries for that matter. And so we had a plan, ironically, to come from east to west, from Nob Noster, Missouri, with the B-2s, which became, Dave can talk about this ad infinitum, but it was the longest air power mission in the history of mankind. And it took 36 hours to get to the target. CENTCOM had no idea about that. It had, without us there, it never would have happened. I would say this, kind of to capsulize the initial part. The initial part of the planning was done almost exclusively from the CAOC, and CENTCOM was kind of along for the ride, and I'd let Dave elaborate on that or such. But the beauty of it is that once we decided what the target was, or it became apparent, it was fairly easy to decide what you had to do. And there was going to be, as President Bush at that time had iterated, a fairly quick response. And again, it's an attribute to U.S. air power primarily. And I'm not talking about air power in general, I'm talking about U.S. air power. The fact that we were able to muster a plan to attack the Taliban within 10 days, there was a lull between the briefing of the plan to the National Security Council and the actual execution on October 7th, and that was basically because of diplomacy and international threats to the Taliban and others. If they didn't do something to give up, basically, they were going to be attacked. But you look back on it, and historically, this moment has been lost, I think, in over the years in the rhetoric, primarily because it was, first of all, most people can't even imagine the amount of effort globally that the Air Force put into this thing. General Mosley can attest to this from being in the Pentagon at the time, the discussions they had there. But from the initial attack, frankly, out of the blue, nobody ever even imagined it, to being able to be ready to go within 10 days says a lot for our country. And it's a hell of a deterrent that's been lost in the wash. So I think this podcast is critical to kind of capture that moment. And then there are other things that occurred that would probably take days to discuss in the aftermath of that. But the initial reaction was, I would say, 100% successful. And it was basically because of what the Air Force had put together and the people on this video.
Now, sir, I appreciate that. And just for clarity's sake here, was there much pushback on your initial concepts that you wanted to roll forward with as a strategy and the operational elements, or was it generally accepted as you guys proposed up front?
I'll synopsize it by saying on the 21st of October, or September, I should say, at the CAOC that Stutz just described, we had a National Intelligence Center in the middle of the CAOC that was for U.S. only people in intel. And that's where we did the video teleconference to President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Chairman Dick Myers, Condoleezza Rice, and Andrew Card in the White House. We set up for that VTC. General Franks flew in from CENTCOM to do the VTC. It was supposed to be at 6 o'clock in the afternoon, Prince time. We got into the facility where there's only Tommy Franks, myself, and a guy named Pete Gersten, who is my aide. We're going to brief the National Security Council. We did. That briefing went on for about an hour. The only people in the National Security Council that said a word, it was President Bush, was the only one, said a couple of comments during the brief. And then at the end of it, he said, okay, I approve the plan, and I want to give you guidance. And the guidance is, I have three things to say. We're going to fight through Ramadan. I don't want you to hit any mosques. And this is your fight to fight as you see fit. I thought that's probably the best strategic guidance you could ever imagine from a president. But no, the answer was the CAOC did the planning. CENTCOM was basically along for the ride, and the National Security Council approved the first plan ad infinitum.
I appreciate that. So General Deptula, as the CAOC director, could you recount how the rules of engagement were a little different from what you experienced as a planner for Desert Storm 10 years earlier? And, you know, how did it affect the execution of the opening of air operations during OEF?
Sure. Now, I'll be happy to try to summarize, but I do recall fondly, General Wald, that first VTC, as we're sitting in theater and all the folks at CENTCOM were in a hurry to get back to the golf course. But back to rules of engagement. What I'd tell you, Doug, is they were absolutely onerous, completely the opposite of Operation Desert Storm, where there was whole delegation of authority to the planners of the attacks. In Afghanistan, no bomb, not a single one, could be dropped without Central Command's senior level approval. And probably the best way to do this is through an example. I'll give you a dramatic one and I'll condense it. This is what happened on the opening night of Enduring Freedom, October 7th, 2001. The intelligence folks had picked up the location of Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, and his senior advisors. And there was a Predator unmanned aerial vehicle, drone, RPA, whatever you'd like to call it, operated by the Central Intelligence Agency. And it was the first one to be equipped with Hellfire missiles. And we were able to track the Taliban convoy through this UAV to a complex of buildings. It was about 13 kilometers southwest of Kandahar. Now, given the potential value of this target, I put two fighters equipped with joint direct attack munitions on station about 20 miles away, because this was early in the morning, and we wanted to minimize the potential for jet noise. But we had it on station to attack once it was authorized. Now, General Wald was trying to get General Franks, the CENTCOM commander, to give him permission to strike the buildings where this senior group was located. And we're both watching the real-time Predator feed there in the Crow's Nest in the Kayak. And time ticked on. Again, we're waiting for permission from General Franks. But as we all found out afterwards, the delay in approval came from concern in the headquarters over potential collateral damage to a nearby mud hut from one of the weapons. And as we're sitting there waiting for approval, suddenly, without authorization from anyone in the theater command chain, we see an explosion on one of the vehicles that are parked outside the building that Mullah Omar and his leadership are in. Now, apparently what had happened, and I found this out many years afterwards, the CIA had ordered the strike due to their frustration with the delay from Central Command. And this was the first use of a weapon from a UAV in conflict. As you might imagine, no damage was done to the Taliban leadership, and they fled the scene. Mullah Omar was never caught, and he died 12 years later from tuberculosis. So, unfortunately, while General Wald was the Joint Force Air Component commander at the time, he'd not authorized the strike. So let me kind of summarize that. I make two major observations from this problematic situation. First, command relationships among the various U.S. government organizations involved should have been established well prior to the operations, with the supported component commander, General Wald, the JFAC in this case, having weapons release authority. Second, and this is an important one, and it's been missed, but most people wouldn't know about this because they weren't there, that concerns over collateral damage should have been weighed against the strategic value of the target. Eliminating Omar and the Taliban leadership on the opening night of the war would have been a huge strategic victory and a devastating blow to the Taliban, something made possible by America's technological advantage. But superior U.S. capabilities were negated in this case by the decision not to authorize weapons release because of fears of collateral damage. So that'll give you some idea of just how rules of engagement affected outcomes and how much the modern telecommunications and the fact that CENTCOM could monitor everything that was going on, just what an impact that had on decision-making. It was so different than just 10 years earlier.
And, sir, who was driving that within the chain?
General Franks.
Now, some powerful lessons there. I mean, if we try to fight China like that, good luck. Okay, Stutz, over to you. You know, talk us through what was going on in the various divisions of the Combined Air Operations Center. You know, what were the biggest challenges in transitioning the KAAC from Southern Watch to running OEF?
Well, I was deep into the sausage making, you might say, as a colonel at that time. And I was one of the permanent parties, so I knew the most. My team knew the most about what was where and what needed to be done. And in a very short time, of course, you have the team from Shaw Air Force Base who have exercised and are trained working for General Wald. They're going to come in and start to work out of this new state-of-the-art KAAC. And there was quite a clash of culture for about a week because the operation in Southern Watch was once again low tempo. You had lots of good office space and in comfort. And suddenly overnight, the Kayak becomes this packed operation. And it was, this new design was such that you could plug in anywhere at any computer and pick up where you left off. There weren't assigned desks. There was not that kind of order. It was truly a combat operation. So there's a little bit of a cultural merge that had to happen there to be able to keep the Southern Watch on track and then plan for Afghanistan. But there was also a huge issue in terms of getting ready, a number of issues, getting planning information, intelligence, even imagery. Satellites were not clearly focused on Afghanistan. The Saudis restricted us bringing certain things into Prince Sultan Air Base. There's a tremendous story of a gent we all know and love who actually smuggled in what was at that time a brand new optical drive with imagery on it so that retired Major General Jim Paas could really spin up his intel operation and get ready for the first strikes that were occurring. Even our weather satellite, which was a French satellite, was iffy because of agreements on what the French wanted to do and did not want to do with the operation. So it maps, for example, Doug, or maps were from the 1970s, and some of them were up to 3,000 feet in error. And we had migrated to GPS-guided bombs. And so without the imagery overhead, without accurate maps, you could not go to a GPS point and blow a bomb up on a given target.
They're Soviet maps, right, Stutz?
Yeah, they were from the 1970s Soviet era, some without any English markings on them. So Jim Paas, the intel guys, were just fantastic in how they had to work around these things. I'll also give a call out to Dave Cotton, who is an incredible communications guy who really got things working by the start of operations on October 7th.
That's incredible. So General Wald, turning to you, General Franks visited the Kayak, as I understand it, in late October or early November. What did you and General Deptula discuss with him, and what was the result of the visit, and how did it affect your plans?
Yeah, thank you. Let me just make a comment that before I get into that. That's that, first of all, as Stutz just described and General Deptula as well, it's pretty incredible the talent of the people that were there and the planning and experience they had. They did a great job under quite a bit of pressure. But I will say this, our part, even though it turned out really, really excellent for the Air Force, I think the hardest part, and General Mosley can talk about this ad infinitum, I think our part was actually kind of easy. I think General Mosley picked up the hard part, and he can talk about that in at length, about the difficulty of transitioning from what was primarily an air kind of campaign to then became a ground campaign. But as far as the execution of the first part of the mission, I mean, the people in the Air Force made it look easy. A 44-hour mission from takeoff to landing in a B-2 is an incredible feat when you only have two people in the aircraft. There was a small, the technology part that Stutz just talked about is incredible. We didn't have Eagle Vision until that technology arrived, Stutz, as you remember. And that became useful quickly. But that was primarily an Army asset that was the Air Force hadn't proliferated yet. Number two is there was a capability that, again, fortunately, had been put on the B-2 just prior to this activity called Combat Track 2. And you could actually, it was kind of like in the movie about You've Got Mail, that you could actually send email to the cockpit. Kind of a small, funny anecdote. The B-2, for those who've been in it, is a pretty big cockpit. The pilot and co-pilot sit quite a ways apart from each other. And on their transit from Nob Nostra to the target in Afghanistan, they would take turns resting. And the typical Air Force guys, they were creative. They put a Walmart lawn chair behind one of the seats in the cockpit of the B-2, and they take turns resting. The problem was the combat track two is on the left side of where the pilot, the primary pilot sat. So we'd send them emails periodically thinking we were clever to make sure they understood, yes, you should keep going. And if it was the pilot resting, he'd have to get up from resting and get over and answer the email. And after they landed, we called him at Diego just to congratulate him on a great mission and tell him thanks. And I asked the pilot, were there any problems during the flight? And he said, the only problem we had is some idiot kept sending us emails. We could never get any rest. So probably a lesson learned there. But I'd go back to the original point I made. Our part was, even though it sounds complex, based on Air Force doctrine, strategy, and training, it went really well. And I have to say this publicly, I kind of pity General Mosley for having to pick up as the kind of supported commander for the ground ops when it happened. And that's a whole new story in itself that he could talk probably 5 or 6 days on. But our part, as hard as it sounds, went really well, primarily based on people and training.
That's impressive. So General Mosley, you know, we've got General Wald, General Deptula, Stutz, they're all in theater running the air war at this time, and you're assigned to take over CENTCOM Air Forces, you know, in November of 2001, a month into combat operations. Can you talk to us what it was like to transition into command amidst the pressure of combat?
Yeah, Doug, thanks. In fact, it was fairly transparent and it was fairly easy. General Wald and I have known each other for so long, and the friendship has been there for so long. It was a privilege to fall in on an operation that he and others had set up. So that part was seamless. But let me go back a little bit. I had been the director of ops of the J3 for the Joint Task Force in a previous life. And then on the Joint Staff, I had been the deputy director for Palmil for the Middle East and Asia. So I was fairly familiar with this piece of the world and fairly familiar with the distances and the ranges and the basing, because I've been to DDPMA and I've been to J3. So when I got ready to leave, talking about maps, another funny piece of this is Scott Kinswater was going to be my aide, but he couldn't leave with me. So I left him a list of things to get. And being a single seat fighter guy, I kind of wanted a map to carry around so I could see where things were and kind of get an idea about correlations and et cetera. So I told him, find me a map. Well, he called as I was leaving and said, boss, there aren't any maps. I've been to the map room. I've been over to Coast Geodetic. I've been everywhere. I can't find you a map. I said, are you telling me there are no maps? And he goes, no, there are no maps. I said, okay, go down to the National Geographic office and buy me a map of Afghanistan. So he did. And that's the map I carried for the entire campaign, was a National Geographic map of Afghanistan. So that tells you there wasn't a whole lot of focus on this place. And remember, it is 600 miles from the North Arabian Sea or from Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, to targets in central Afghanistan. From Diego Garcia to targets in central Afghanistan is the same distance from Tampa, Florida, to Juneau, Alaska. Think about that. And General Wald is right. This evolution realized for the United States Air Force, these are the longest bomber missions flown to date, 44 to 45 hours, the longest fighter missions flown to date, the longest UAV missions flown to date, the largest humanitarian airdrop ever, the longest combat search and rescue missions. So this place was out of the way. This wasn't just adjacent to some friendly country. You had to fly over the Hindu Kush Mountains. You had to go around places to get to targets to get into this place. I think there's a natural break in the strategic thinking here. What General Wall was tasked to do was topple the country to go after the leadership. And in a way, in my transition, it changed to hunting down individual people or groups of people. And the frustration that we had at the time with the staff at Tampa, which didn't change, by the way, until we got into Iraq, was on Saturday they would show up in golf shirts for the BTC, just like General Wall said. So we always knew it was Saturday. And on Thursday at Prince Sultan was Cajun Meatloaf Day at the mess hall. So you knew it was Thursday when there was Cajun Meatloaf, and you knew it was Saturday when they showed up in golf shirts. Other than that, this was a template that was like a no-fly zone, a little bit on steroids, because we were still conducting both the northern no-fly zone, the southern no-fly zone, while we were doing Afghanistan. And the ROE for Afghanistan was different written, but in practice, it was nothing different. It was exactly the same as the no-fly zone. And remember, in the southern no-fly zone, under the existing ROE, if you got shot at, you had to leave. And then you had to go away, and you had to come back and get authorities to come back and drop on somebody that just shot at you. And so the ROE in practice for the remainder of my time up until we got into Iraq was very restricted. The staff at Tampa was very reluctant to turn over authorities. And in fact, even had us investigate ourselves on several targets relative to violation of the laws of armed conflict, which fascinated me. But you had a transition from toppling a regime to hunting down single individuals or groups of individuals with a very restrictive ROE. But part of that was made easier by our relationship with some civilian entities, some other government agencies that we had direct contact with. And then also late 2001 was when the first special U.S. Special Forces folks showed up. And so it was still mostly an air campaign facilitated by small groups of people on the ground. And it didn't really change. It didn't really ramp up until much later when conventional Army folks showed up. And then that became a whole different set of interface challenges and prioritization. We even had a division commander subordinate to the SYNC and subordinate to the land component commander plan an operation on his own, a major operation on his own, without telling anybody, which kind of upset most of us. So the rest of the time in Afghanistan before we went into Iraq, in my view, was, again, simply hunting people and hunting small groups of people until the Army began to put in larger numbers of folks. Well, actually, let me take that back. The first conventional non-special forces folks that went into Afghanistan was Jim Mattis and a Marine task force that went into Kandahar. And that's the story there about how well that worked and why it worked well. But I think for my piece of this portion of Operation Enduring Freedom, the lesson learned here is you can't do this with restrictive ROE. You can't do this with handcuffs on finding and fixing, confirming and striking or not striking, which is the exact lesson we learned. And we built up a set of confidences with General Franks that the execution of Operation Iraqi Freedom was 180 degrees different than this. So, Doug, hopefully that ties up the strategic planning piece for you.
No, sir, I appreciate that. And just this rules of engagement piece, I mean, we look at how things proliferated out over the years and what we ended up with, the Operation Inherent Resolve in Syria, I mean, it just got worse and worse and worse. And we've got to drop this and pivot for peer conflict, or none of it will work for us. Stutz, I want to pick up on a detail General Mosley mentioned, and that's about challenges involving range. And people really need to understand that we had no bases around Afghanistan when OEF kicked off. I mean, we're flying crews to the edge of their physical endurance to execute missions. You know, we had carriers offshore, but they could only generate so many sorties a day. And as General Mosley said, they weren't exactly close. So could you go into this from your perspective?
Yes. Well, General Waldan Mosley of us spoke to this earlier. The distances were huge. And you have to understand that the nature of this operation from the start to the end of it was all about the geography. And, you know, we call this in the Air Force the magic of global reach, being able to get our strike capabilities, our ISR capabilities anywhere that we need to be. So we had to manufacture this tanker bridge and a communications bridge across Pakistan and into Afghanistan to be able to go these extraordinary distances. You know, some of these missions in bases around the region, you know, might be a 2,000 mile just transportation haul, and then you have to loiter in the target area to be able to prosecute targets. So there's one example of a Strike Eagle, F-15E, a pair of Strike Eagles. They flew a historic 15 and a half hour mission. I believe that was Crockett flight. You know, they go to the tanker, they top off, they loiter probably at that time about 45 minutes waiting for intel to generate targets, strike, or just loiter waiting, because we had this ocean of air power overhead waiting at all times to pursue Taliban and Al-Qaeda targets. And then they would fly back to the tanker, top off, and that would happen many, many, many times. And this was a particularly demanding mission. But it characterized what many of the airmen were doing at the time. As far as carrier ops, that was a learning curve in itself. We were not familiar, many of us, with, of course, carriers, and we had to weigh upon experience in the fight to understand how to factor them into keeping that strike capability unbroken. And the carrier is a very delicate thing. Fortunately, the risk to the carrier was low, so most of its air strike capability could be given to the air component commander to be used. But the carrier has a low sortie generation rate. You can't get too many airborne because you can't get them back on. The fighters could not land on the carriers with their ordnance. If they didn't expend that ordnance, we had to find places for them to jettison that. If a deck was fouled, it stops all production of sorties off the carrier. Could be an arresting gear malfunction, could be a mishap on the carrier deck. And then frequently the carrier's got to withdraw to do resupply and major maintenance. And so it took us a while to really coordinate and understand that, but it was the land base air that could really generate just such a large number of sorties to be able to keep this going. And I'll stop there. There's probably more that General Wald and Mosley can talk about with respect to those distances and carrier operations.
Hey, Stutz, let me reinforce a thought for you about the tankers and about fuel.
Sure.
At the time, we had KC-135Es. I think they had TF-33 engines. We had KC-135Rs that had CFM56 engines, and we had KC-10s on the American side. But on the British side, we had the TriStars, and I think there were another thing that was a Comet-based tanker, if I remember right. So there were a set of tankers, but the lesson learned, a million lessons learned from Red Flags and Coke Thunders and et cetera, is the tanker is the single point of failure in any of this stuff. It's even more so when you're operating at these ranges. So in the temperatures and pressure altitudes of the AOR, we eventually banned the KC-135E from deploying because it couldn't take off with any fuel to offload. It couldn't take fuel because the KC-135, there are only eight of them in the entire inventory that can receive fuel. And those are the Jim Bear tankers that were the old SR-71 birds. So every KC-135 could not receive fuel other than those eight. And the 135E couldn't lift enough fuel to make it worthwhile. So we were down to the KC-135Rs and the KC-10s and the TriStars. And I can't remember what that other airplane was called. It was kind of a Nimrod Comet-looking thing, but it was a tanker also. And so what we learned, and I think if we could go back in time, it would have been obvious to us if we had thought about it this way. We positioned the KC-10s and the Jim Bear tankers so that if any tanker was leaving the airspace that had excess fuel to getting it to its home station, we would dump that fuel in the tankers overhead Afghanistan with the objective of trying to keep 200 to 250,000 pounds of fuel in the air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I think as a bunch of fighter pilots, we would have probably thought of that, but we didn't until we were forced to think of that. And after looking back on it, it was kind of genius that we thought about it because it defined, in my mind anyway, in the jobs that I had subsequent to that, it firmed up in my mind the requirement for the tanker to be able to receive fuel as well as transfer fuel and to look for engine designs and mold-line designs that give you those efficiencies so you can, once you get out there, don't bring gas home. Once you get into the AOR, into the airspace, keep the fuel out there because bringing fuel home does nobody any good. So, Doug, that was kind of an interesting lesson learned on the fly that is enduring even today as we look at the Boeing KC-46, which I'm not sure why we haven't fined those people for not bringing that airplane on board. And then we look at a KCY competition, but it's all the same. The fuel and the tanker is the single point failure in operating at those ranges. So Just a thought.
Hey, by the way, Chief, let me pitch back in too. Is if you recall, also those tankers were vulnerable because the terrain was so high in some of the tanker tracks, and they did not have self-protection. Those crews were just magnificent. They never squeaked about it. They were always up there watching that risk. But interesting when we think about a follow-on tanker, what it needs to be able to operate anywhere in the world.
Now, those are interesting perspectives, and I'm glad you guys brought it up, because so often we focus on the pointy nose jets, so to speak, and it's important to think about the enterprise that makes it all work. With that, we're going to look forward to finishing the rest of this discussion next week. I'd like to extend a big thank you for our guests for joining in today's discussion, and I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. And if you liked what you've heard today, don't forget to hit that like button and follow and subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment and let us know what you think about our show or areas that you think we should explore further. And as always, you can join in the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. So thanks again for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.